Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, we speak with Robin DeJesus. We also talk about the International Thespian Festival in Nebraska, Holler If You Hear Me, Tick Tick Boom, 54 Sing 1776, Meeting Our Heroes, which was a nymph event, a bunch of other things, so please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, July 13th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk in Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com, as well as many other places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So we're back together after a brief summer hiatus. You know, we are very fortunate that our season sort of wraps up in June and gets a little bit slower. We're able to take a little bit of a break, but we're hitting the ground running again.
I don't know how much of a break I took, given that I saw 14 shows in 6 days out in Nebraska with the International Thespian Festival in Lincoln, Nebraska, which is really sensational because all these schools come from here, there, and everywhere to perform. They've won regional competitions, and the Mary Poppins was amazing beyond belief. You know, did Mary Poppins fly? Yes. Did the kid go around the proscenium arch? Yes, I'm telling you, this is a school from Henderson, Nevada, and their souvenir booklet, their playbill, is as good as a Broadway production. It's Las Vegas casinos advertised in it. I mean, really, it was something to see. The Catch Me If You Can, the two leads were amazing. I mean, especially the Norbert Leo Butz character, because you thought that he was cast because he was a comic character. And he was. He was very good with the comedy of that character. However, then he sang and he was magnificent as a singer. So
wow.
That was amazing. Yeah, it was really something. Also, Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman were out there, speaking of Catch Me If You Can, and they did a workshop. And there was a very interesting situation where I was taking notes, and I was sitting behind three young men who have been following theater for probably 2 or 3 years and therefore know everything. Everything, you know, because they've seen Wicked 3 times and Next to Normal twice, you know, so therefore they know everything about Broadway musicals now. As Sondheim said, everybody has to go through stages like that. I remember when I knew everything, too. And now, of course, many years later, I know comparatively nothing. Well, anyway, boy, were they mocking every kid that got up to audition.
Oh.
Until Alex Stone got up there. And I'm telling you, they were the first to lead the standing ovation. This kid became a star overnight. It was amazing to see, because the next day he was in the next 5 years and was that lobby packed. Kids wanting to see this kid. So there may be a bright future for Alex Stone. I wouldn't be a bit surprised. Anyway, I'm sorry I stepped on the introduction to Michael. I apologize.
That's okay. It was that sounds very exciting. You've been out there at the International Thespian Festival a number of times, haven't you?
Just once. This is my second year, and I hope to go every year. Because
I believe it hasn't it been going on for many years? Because I used to hear about that. I think when I was in school. Is that not correct?
Yes. In Lincoln alone, this was the 20th year, It had been going on long before that. So I think it may even date back to the 30s. I'm really not sure. But
yeah, when I was in school.
Yeah, see, you were right.
Sorry.
Yeah. Nah. All right, James, I'm through.
Well, you know, I this is all good information. I have to tell you that before you talked about it, I guess last year, I thought it was maybe a few years ago, but I guess it was last year you talked about it. I had never heard about it, and it's great for everybody to find out about these things. So please, and it sounds like if you went back, it must have been good because.
Oh, I'd love to go back every year. I mean, really, seeing 2-3 shows a day, phenomenal, and just nice meeting. Oh, and by the way, colleges recruit there too. And when I first day there, I called up a friend. And I said, "There's got to be 24 colleges here recruiting kids to come to their schools." It turned out to be 52 colleges where they're recruiting kids to come to their schools. So so it's a nice place for that, too.
So Alex Stone, is that his name?
Yes, Alex same name.
Alex Stone, he's the LeBron James of high school theater?
Right, but he ain't going to Cleveland, I'll tell you that. I mean, I mean he's coming to Broadway. Yes, that was the same name as Donna Reed's husband on her TV series. But and while it'd be nice if Alex turned out to be a doctor, I do think he has show business ahead of him. So anyway.
Stone and Stein on City of Angels, did they have first names? I don't remember.
I think they do.
Maybe I think not. They Maybe didn't. Not. I think they didn't. But right. Yeah, maybe he's really Alex Stein. He's already changed his name. Who knows?
Yeah, or maybe he goes, you know, when he's performing at festivals, he's Alex Stone, but when he's at
That's
home,
right.
he's Alex Stein.
Stein, right. Good for you. All right, Michael deserves an introduction.
Yes, and so, Michael, how are you? How was your couple of weeks off?
Oh, it was fine. Yeah, I've been seeing stuff too. You know, I guess as you said, it you know things kind of stop right after the Tonys, and then but then they pick if nothing else, then they pick up again with the festivals, Nymph and the other ones, and then shows start popping up off Broadway, and then we did have the one Broadway opening, Holler if you hear me. So yeah, you know it's we don't never go too long without stuff. Happening.
Well, Holler if you hear me is we can talk about it briefly. It did open up 4 weeks or so ago. I think that Peter spoke about it a couple of weeks ago, but Michael and I were going to see it right after Peter saw it. And so, Michael, briefly, what do you think about Holler?
Well, I said exactly the same thing as several other people that I know who saw it said, which was I didn't hate it. Mm-hmm. And actually, parts of it I liked quite a bit. And I don't think I said this on the podcast. I can't remember now, but I've said it so many times. I was very pleasantly surprised at how much actual singing was in it. Because I always associate rap and hip hop with no singing. You know, but then I remember that, I know we discussed this at the time, when this show was originally announced, the press release came out and it said something about, I believe the phrasing was, based on the lyrics of Tupac Shakur, lyrics and words of Tupac Shakur.
Uh-huh.
But there was no music credit. And I thought, and I said, I think this is the first time I've ever seen a press release for a Broadway musical with no music credit. Then it was explained to me by people who know about these things that in rap, generally, it's the producer who comes up with whatever music accompanies the rap. You know?
No kidding. Mm-hmm.
That
wow.
Yeah. So therefore, it could be like if you were to listen to 10 songs by Tupac Shakur, the music, such as it is, might be by 10 different people. But then I also noticed that there's a musical supervisor, or I believe credited for this show, and I can only assume that some of the singing music. Was written specifically for this show. There were a couple of songs that were not rap or hip hop by any means. There's a beautiful song that I know several people who really loved it. That woman sings in the first act when she's putting on her dress. Mm-hmm. There were a couple of others that were really more R&B or almost like pop ballads than hip hop or rap. I really liked those parts. I also liked some of the rap parts. But one thing I was discussing with a friend is that I missed a lot of the lyrics, and it was partly the sound, you know, the amplification, the mix between the vocals and the orchestra or the band, but it was also that rap lyrics tend to be so fast, you know? And yes, we have musical theater lyrics that are fast, like Getting Married Today from Coming, you know, but it's but the difference is in musical theater, it's usually only for a short period at a time. You know, it's not like constantly that this all of these words are being thrown at you very fast without a break. And then not to mention the fact that we have false rhymes or no rhymes rather than true rhymes to help us along. Rap rarely has true rhymes. For that those reasons, I think I missed a lot of the lyrics. But I actually liked a lot of the show, especially for the first act. I thought they really copped out tremendously at the end, and I can't, you know, say any more because it would be a big spoiler. But the thing that happens at the end, the way it happens, I thought it was a tremendous cop out for a show that was trying to be, you know, very edgy and very realistic. And you know, a lot of it was very cliched, but there were good things in it too. Christopher Jackson, who plays one of the male leads, who many of you may know from In the Heights. He was terrific, and I always like him. And Tanya Pinkins was in it, you know, so we have some real theater people to kind of anchor it. And so that's my take on it. I don't know. If you'd like to see it, I think you should do so soon because lots of publicity about how much money they're losing and blah, blah, blah. So...
And yeah, that's why maybe you should give the ending, because a lot of people aren't going to see it. Yeah, they just will not go. So, frankly, I expected business to be better. Mm. I thought there would be an audience for this, and apparently there isn't.
Yeah, well, and I don't know. I mean, it's hard. It's hard to, because as we've mentioned, they decreased the number of seats in the palace by, was it 500?
Yeah,
it's about 500. Because they reconfigured the actually what they did is they built a stadium seating plan above the existing seats in the orchestra. Yeah. And I do keep hearing that the palace is due for a renovation. But then someone else just told me that the money is not actually in place for that yet. So it may not happen as early as we all thought. Mm. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see on that.
Yeah, but these are grosses that would have embarrassed a musical in the 80s.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the seating configuration change, just to describe it a little bit better, went from the first row. They created a rake that met the lip of the front mezzanine. Right. So it looked like the seats went straight from the front row all the way to the back of the theater. Yeah. So bypassing the orchestra, quote-unquote, part of it. Then there's a railing, and then there's the mezzanine section. It was dramatic. Did you notice do you think that the orchestra was under the...
Well, part of it
under the seats.
Part of it. I mean, you could see the back part of it. I wasn't sure if they. I think maybe they had to take out maybe only a few rows at the very front part of the orchestra. Mm-hmm. I'm guessing, and then they built, but then they built over the rest of it. That's what I'm guessing.
Yeah. So it was in the news this week that they were raising $5 million to keep the show going. Trying to raise $5 million to keep the show going, and that the landlords haven't invoked a stop clause, which is when you fall below a certain number, they can close the show. The landlord can close the show, not the producers.
Well, James corrected me because I don't know. I had just had the wrong thing in my head. I think there is a certain number of performances that a show needs to run. Is it the same for every show, James?
It's usually
23.
It starts at 23, Peter, because the longer it runs, the higher percentage goes.
Oh, okay. So at a minimum of 23 performances, the producers are vested to some degree.
They get like 5% or something like that.
And then it increases, you said, to 100 performances?
up to 40%, and I think that the number is 100 performances. I'm not positive about that. But the thing that I was wondering about was that how encumbered this particular property would be in a traditional sense, since the music is from somewhere else and has lots of different people involved with it. So I wasn't really positive about the actual numbers there, but I think that they want to keep it running because it would make sense to tour it or make sense to make a movie of this or something like that. And it would financially, they've lost their initial investment. The way to get it back is to keep this thing running.
I can't help feeling, maybe this is tremendously obvious, to state that it shouldn't have been in a Broadway theater to begin with. Maybe it could have been at the Beacon, you know, but again, maybe they specifically wanted to make a point of bringing it to Broadway, and maybe they had hopes of, I mean, you don't necessarily know how much it means to people in other fields like that to win a Tony Award or get Tony nominations or even to say direct from Broadway.
Sure.
But, So maybe they did it specifically because they wanted to do all that, or maybe they just did it because they got a real incredible sweetheart deal from the Nederlanders.
Yeah.
Or both.
So, yeah. So Tick, Tick, Boom continues to roll in very low grosses, but has stuck it out much longer than many people thought.
Not
Tick, Tick, Boom.
Yeah. You need an edit.
Holler if you hear me. Which kills my transition to Tick, Tick, Boom.
Yeah, I suppose it does.
You see, this is what happens. I'm looking at Tick, Tick, Boom in my eyes, and I said Tick, Tick, Boom. So anyway, so Michael saw Tick, Tick, Boom at Encores. Michael, tell us about that.
Well, I think it's grosses for whatever the four performances that they did. I think were phenomenal. It certainly seemed packed when I went. I love this show so much. I like it better than Rent. It was written by Jonathan Larson, originally as a one-man show for himself, basically one man with, I guess, a band in the background and some people maybe like chiming in to sing in the background. But he was he was front and center, and he was the soloist. And it's very, very autobiographical about his early days of, struggling to write musical theater and feeling very disappointed and disillusioned because he's turning 30 and he doesn't think he's as far along as he should be, and he's working in a diner and he doesn't really like it, and just hoping something will click and blah blah blah. And it's really very moving in retrospect, of course, because we do hear and see a song from a show called Superbia, which he was in fact writing at that time and did a workshop of. And then the big song from that is called "Come to Your Senses," that is sung by in this production by Karen Olivo in the role of Caressa, I believe that's the name of the actress who's performing the song. But then there is a reference at some point to just a passing reference. John says. Alludes to the next show that he's writing, and he doesn't say Rent, and he doesn't really say anything about it, but you know that it's Rent, and you know what that was going to turn into, and we all know in retrospect how he died suddenly on the night of the day of the first public performance. And it's just I mean the show is moving enough as it is, just as a portrait of a struggling young artist in musical theater, and then to have all that knowledge in hindsight, it's just incredible. And I love all the songs, I love all the music. Just quickly, when the performance started for the first 5 minutes, I was almost incredulous. Because I'm sorry to say, Lin-Manuel Miranda as John sang off pitch so often and so badly that I could not believe what I was hearing. And I thought, this is going to be the most disastrous evening I've ever spent in the theater. Then I don't know what happened. It got much better. I mean, it was never great, but it's almost like he I almost got the impression that he doesn't really he doesn't have a lot of experience actually singing, you know, in performance, because 90% of his role in The Heights was rap or, you know, speak singing. And so maybe he's just not used to it. And maybe the more he does it, you know, even on a specific night, it gets better. So I mean, other than that, he was fantastic. I still don't know if it's worth it to have given him the part for those first 5 or 10 minutes that made me incredibly uncomfortable and fearful of what was going to come next. But that is what happened with him. And I've never had that experience before, especially not where it then got better. So I really can't explain that. And for what it's worth, by the way, I didn't think he was especially good in Merrily We Roll Along in Encores, but I don't remember noticing pitch problems. So I'm not sure exactly, you know, as I said, what's going on with that. Leslie Odom Jr., who played Michael, John's best friend, and other roles, had no problems with pitch. He was great. And Karen Olivo, returning at least briefly, played these female roles, and primarily John's girlfriend, Susan. And as I said before, that woman, Caressa, that actress who sings Comes to Your Senses. I loved seeing the show again. I saw it originally with the original cast, Raul Esparza and A.B. Spanger and Jerry Dixon, and we'll never forget that. I believe it's produced fairly often. Mm-hmm. You know, considering,
yes, it is.
Yeah. So that does my heart really really good. And Peter, you missed it, yes.
Yes, I was probably seeing In the Heights at that moment in time.
Oh.
In Nebraska. So we both did our homage to Lin-Manuel. You know, the thing is that, it's surprising to hear this from the vantage point that, after all, he had to do that very difficult Franklin Shepard, Inc. At Merrily, and that's not an easy song to accomplish. And I know that at a Sondheim benefit some years ago, somebody was just completely in a different key from what everybody else was playing. Now and then it happens, and I guess it happened to him. So that's a shame.
Well, I mean, we all knew, that he doesn't have a great voice, but as far as actual pitch problems, I didn't hear any of that in Merrily.
Yeah, indeed.
I mean, and that song you mentioned, Franklin Shepard Inc., I should say, that has very few, if any, held notes, which is where there seemed to be the problem. Our time has sustained notes.
Sure.
So, and I didn't notice it there either. So I don't know what to say.
Good thing going, too, for that matter.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure. Mm.
All right, so that's Tick, Tick, Boom, and of course that was Limited Engagement at Encores. Another limited engagement that Michael and Peter got out to see was it called 54 Sings 1776? Is that the official title?
Correct, mm-hmm. Yes.
So Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I adore 1776. It's one of my favorite experiences of all time. This was a quite abbreviated version, because it really was a concert more than everything else, though it was quite nice at the beginning in the Sit Down John number, when there were all the delegates around sitting at tables, and so they got up and started singing Sit Down John, and that was tremendously effective. So some people were better than others at singing, no question about that. Some were more right for the roles than others. Yeah. And that was fine too. Great fun to hear the score. Certainly Molasses to Rum tore down the house tremendously. I thought it might have even been the best rendition I heard, and because I didn't get a playbill, I didn't really know who was who. Was there a playbill, Michael?
No, I don't think so. I had the release with me, but I'm happy to say that was Brian Charles Rooney, who I must say previously had not really made that great an impression on me in anything. Well, the major thing he had done before this was that really unfortunate revival of Three Penny Opera at the Roundabout, in which he played one of the female roles. It's not that there was anything wrong with him, with his performance in that. It's just that I didn't like the concept. I didn't like the production. But he was really excellent, wasn't he, Peter?
Good. I'm glad you agree. Yeah.
Yes.
So I thought he was very good. I did think that the woman who was singing, played the violin, was very wrong for the role. She seemed a bubble-headed valley girl more than anything else. I don't know who it was, and I'm not going to give her name. But
I think she completely misread it, aside from singing a lot of wrong lyrics. Did you notice that? She misread in overplaying the sexuality of it from the beginning. I mean, the whole point of the song, it's the whole charm of it is that it's subtle, you know. I mean, it's about sex, and it's a metaphor of him playing the violin meaning something else, but you don't go, oh, he never speaks his pat, that.
Right, so you anyway, agree that she wasn't so hot.
Yeah,
not so. I'm going to say something that may be controversial, but the MC, Rob Maintner, did an excellent job of tracking down material and background information on this show. And I thought his facts and figures were terrific. However, he did have a very great gay sensibility. And 1776 isn't a show that lends itself to that type of delivery. And I did find him at the end even making a statement about gay rights that, Michael, see if you agree with me, I felt the house resisted. I felt that the audience was not taking to his political standpoint on gay rights. Did you feel that?
Oh, yes. I mean, I agree that – I mean, I don't think the audience is against gay rights, but it just
– No. Yeah, I don't mean that.
I know. Yeah. No, it just seemed like a little sledgehammery, even though I suppose he's right. I mean, you know, he was making the point that there's always somebody fighting for their rights, and this is, sometimes it's blacks, sometimes it's gays, sometimes it's women. And I think he mentioned the women's, basically the women's suffrage, and women's rights also. But yes, I do agree with you that it just seemed, it's like when somebody gets up at an Oscars telecast and says something political.
Well, also his delivery for the rest of it too was a very gay camp, and this is a show that doesn't lend itself to that. But I was grateful for the facts and figures because I know a lot of them, and I didn't find any mistakes. Though that could only mean that I'm mistaken in what I think to be right about 1776, about what had happened, out of town and during the run and the controversy with the Nixon administration not wanting to see a certain number, and how that wound up even impacting the film a little later. So, you got to give credit to this Jennifer Ashley Tepper, who is really getting everything in there. I mean, it seems like there's never a dull moment at 54 Below. And my hat is really off to her for going out there and saying to people, what do you got? What can you bring to us? What can happen here? There are so many different types of things that are happening at 54 Below. I live in the neighborhood, and occasionally I'm walking down that street, and there's always a switchboard sign out there saying tonight, and it's two or three events. God love her for really making things happen. I think she's really a terrific producer, and I think 54 Below is extraordinarily lucky to have her because she is really on the ball.
I am talking into a muted microphone. Apologies. Okay. But I said wonderful, wonderful things about everybody. You're all thin and beautiful. Okay.
Right.
So before we were talking about Tick, Tick, Boom, I meant to ask you guys, because it was over to the left, did you guys get a chance to see The Lion? We didn't talk about it on here, did we?
No, and it's been getting some wonderful, wonderful reviews, hasn't it?
It really has. Today it's today is the last day of The Lion, and given the stellar, amazing reviews that it received, I wonder if it's going to have an afterlife somewhere else. Peter, you didn't see it, did you?
No.
I wish I had seen that instead of the other show that was MTC that I did see, which was when we were young and unafraid, which I still can't even think about because it makes me angry. But The Lion, apparently it is a one person show.
Yeah, it seems like. I didn't see it, so I'm just talking about.
I have a feeling we're going to see it again somewhere because it seemed like people really, really loving it.
Yeah, it's really, really amazing. It says the true story of love loss, family loyalty, and the redemptive power of music. So, and the gentleman, it's written, performed by Benjamin Schuer?
Schuer, I think.
Schuer. Oh, and it's got a special offer. Use code 13304 to pre-purchase $5 drink, wine, beer, or soda, redeemable at the theater bar. Ooh. Oh, okay. So
I kind of like that Bacharach show at
New York Theater Workshop.
Thank you. It probably doesn't hurt that the guy is really cute. And that there was an interview with him. I think it was in the Times or some other rager thing about him, how charming and talented and cute he was and how good the show is. So, so I think we'll be seeing it.
Ben Brantley did the interview.
Did I say that? No.
I was being facetious.
Oh, sorry.
Ben Brantley fawning over Stars, you know.
Oh yeah, but not in. Gotcha.
So this the Lion came from the 2013 Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and was seen at the Kennedy Center and the Actors Theatre of Louisville. Actors Theatre of Louisville does some great stuff. You ever been down there?
Just once. To see Dancing at Lunacy. That I just happened to be in the neighborhood. It wasn't like I went down there to see that.
Yeah.
But I'm a little embarrassed that I've never been to the Umana Festival, but so many things.
Only so much time in the day.
It really is, yeah.
And the Kennedy Center sideshow is getting a lot of buzz and talks about bringing it to New York and what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Our friend Steve Bell is saw it yesterday, so I might have him on next week to talk for 5 minutes about what he saw because he knows sideshow very well. All right, Steve doesn't know that yet, so if Steve's probably listening to this and saying what, so I have to talk to him and see if he can come on next week and chat about that. So next up is Michael saw a thing called the Meeting Our Heroes, which is the NIMH Festival had an event about meeting the great writers in musical theater. So, Michael, tell us quickly about that.
Well, again, Jennifer Ashley Tepper, she didn't, I believe, produce this one, but she was the onstage interviewer, and it was really a wonderful event. They had the established composers. Michael John Lacusa, Stephen Flaherty, John Bacchino, and Charles Strauss. And then they had a series of young composers who have been inspired by them. And so music was performed by both the established and the aspiring, up-and-coming composers. And it was really just very well done. And then Jennifer, as I said, she interviewed the aspirants or the whatever, the up and comers and the veterans on stage at the same time. And it was just really fantastic to have that kind of to have that idea to begin with. And then, to have it come to fruition. That must be so thrilling for those younger people. Can you imagine? So it really, I mean, it seemed to me like the perfect event for NIMH. And it was actually on the first day of NIMH, because I know that the opening party was that evening. So I think that was probably a really, really great way to kick it off.
So that's all coming up soon, and your schedules are all booked for seeing 87 shows, something like
that.
Yeah,
it's true. It's true. They are adding up, aren't they?
Yes. Glad we had this quick, brief break from the incredibly busy schedule. Michael also got over to see the West Village Musical Theater Festival. So, Michael, tell us about that.
Yes, this is now. Oh, how many years is it now? Gosh, I don't have it. It's been going on for several years now. Actually, a friend of mine, Patrick Wickham, is the founder, and I guess the gimmick here or the thing that sets it apart from some of the other festivals is these are very brief musicals, like 15-minute musicals. And you like there were five series, A, B, C, D, E, and each one had five musicals in it. So you were there for like an hour and a half. Or an hour and 15 minutes, roughly, you know, with scene changes and everything for each musical. And it was at the Players Theater in the Village. And it was really great to see. I mean, obviously, the level of composition and talent is not equal from one to the next. But there was lots of worthwhile stuff. I'll make a blanket statement that it seemed like the biggest problem overall was the lyrics. which, as Peter and I have discussed many, many times, you know, we really don't like lyrics that don't rhyme. And as I was discussing recently with Stephen Dolgunov, who's a musical theater writer himself, I don't like false rhymes. But what I think what bothers me even more is if like the lyrics in a show rhyme 85% of the time, and then the other 15% they don't, because then it really just seems like carelessness, you know. Like you know, it's not a decision that I don't want them to rhyme. It's like, well, I can't always think of the right something that's going to rhyme. And as we've said earlier, it makes it, aside from everything else, it makes it more difficult to understand the lyrics because the rhymes help you, you know.
Yes, they do.
Now, having said that, one of the great things about this West Village Musical Theater Festival is it was performed with the singers were completely unamplified. And they did a really good job. I mean, it's a pretty small theater. It's narrow and long, but it's not wide at all. So they had the band, which consisted of basically maybe two keyboards and maybe a drummer in some cases, was in the front, like in the front of the house. So the band was actually between the stage and the audience on the same level. But as I say, there were only like two or three of them, and they kept the volume on the electronic instruments very low, which how often does that happen? So it was really great to hear all of these young, talented young people singing these songs unamplified in a theater, in a musical, because how often do you get to hear that anymore? And I guess the last thing I would say is, given what I said about the lyrics being the problem, my favorite of the five 15-minute musicals that I saw was Romeo and Juliet, the rock opera, because most of it was the Shakespeare text. With it says book, music, and lyrics by Michael O'Neill, but he really wrote some excellent music to and these were sometimes they're not really 15-minute musicals, they're like excerpts of larger musicals, and in this series I think that's what they were. So we got the prologue, which was sung by Friar Lawrence, actually, a black male performer, a really kind of very powerful, you know, jazzy, bluesy kind of number that the prologue turned into. And then the balcony scene was just beautiful music written to that incredible poetry by Shakespeare. So I hope to see the full version of Romeo and Juliet, the rock opera, at some point, because I really liked what I saw. And and the one final thing I'll say is they have awards for these for the festival. They call it the Westies, and actually they have a little trophy that this year it's like a little dog, the head of a dog. I guess it's supposed to be like a Westie dog. Mm-hmm. It's cute. And but anyway, so they I went to the award ceremony, and they're announcing all the winners, most 99% of whom I'd never heard of. But then they got to best lyrics, Sheldon Harnick. And I turned around to the person behind me, and I said, amateur.
He's not going anywhere.
So that was, but just the fact that he won it, you know, he participated and won an award with these, you know, with these 22-year-olds, that in itself was fantastic.
So I was looking on their website and I see stuff dating back to 2010. Peter got a chance to see Rocky again. Peter, tell us about Rocky. What made you go back again?
Well, I liked it the first time, and they were having those $40 seats, and I thought, all right, you know, it's close to where I live. So one night on impulse, I went and had a really wonderful time. I do believe this is a very underrated musical, and I'm sorry that it hasn't had much more success because I'm very moved by the story. As I mentioned way back when, I think the screenplay has been improved because there's much more involved with Christmas and New Year's, which figure in very significantly into the plot. So I like that very much. I'm happy to say it's in wonderful shape, that nobody's just walking through figuring, oh, we're in this not successful musical, so why bother? So I'm not just talking about the last 20 minutes, which everybody talks about. I'm talking about what leads up to it. I think Lynn Aaron's lyrics are tremendously insightful and intelligent, and I do believe, too, that Steve Flaherty's music does establish time and place very, very well. It sounds very 70s to me, and that's, of course, when the story takes place. There was no attempt to update it. There's even mention of the bicentennial and all that, so under those circumstances, I thought it was really, really terrific. And, you know, I've been sending a lot of people to the show, and the people I've sent have not been complaining afterwards. You know, gee, I didn't think I'd like it, but it really turned out to be good. And, you know, and they're not just talking about the last 20 minutes either. They're talking about what leads up to it. So I have to say, too, whatever this is worth, the audience seemed to be with it every step of the way. I do not mean just the last 20 minutes. I mean every step of the way. So really, I'm going to entreat people out there. I'm not an investor in the show. I have no vested interest in it beyond the fact of being very fond of it. Give it a try. I think you're going to be delightfully surprised at how moved you are by these two people who have been beaten down. One by his parents, one by her brother, and believe that they're nothing much of anything. And yet, together, they can really forge a wonderful relationship and encourage each other, and that they can really bloom. And that's really a nice thing to see, because many of us have been discouraged by people who should not have discouraged us. In the title of the show, there was that Die Vampire Die song that alluded to this. Well, that's a lot of what Rocky is about. So, by all means, you know, if you're wondering what to see and you haven't landed on a show that you have really selected and you're still searching through the ABCs trying to figure out what it should be, make it Rocky.
So Rocky is doing, you know, between $600,000 and $700,000 business. It's not quite in terrible financial shape, but this is the time of the year when you're harvesting crops. You know, you know, you need to make your money over the summer to make it through the winter.
We should mention Andy Carl was featured in the finale of this year's National High School Musical Theater Awards.
Yes, he was.
Yeah. He was the special guest, and they did, I would say, one of the better songs from Rocky. Was it the first act closer, Peter? Do you know it?
No, I really didn't at that point because I had not received the album yet and I hadn't gone back to see it. So I'm not sure what song was done. It was
a very inspirational song about, you know, you know, you have to do this and you know, you're going to do it. So I thought it certainly seemed appropriate for the Jimmy Awards. And it was great to see Andy doing it. And, you know, he did a great job with it, of course. And the kids worked well with him. And that was really nice.
It was a very good show, and certainly the people who won, I think, were audience favorites.
Mm,
I think
yes,
you do too. Yeah. It's an amazing thing to see kids taking a Broadway stage with Lion King usually plays, and there were 52 of them, 26 boys, 26 girls, all competing for each for a $10,000 scholarship prize. And while I'm sure the money is delightful, I have a feeling that the money wasn't even the biggest thrill for some of these kids. I really mean that, that they were really much more intent on getting up there and showing what they could do, and to realize that as teenagers, they could say, I played Broadway.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had Van Kaplan on
yes.
a couple of weeks ago. And I'm glad you guys brought up the Jimmys, because I had meant to, and I forgot. So,
and just when I had forgotten that Ryan McCartan, who came,
wasn't that something?
Well, he was the host this year, and he only 2 years ago.
Yeah,
he was one of the winners, and I had forgotten that was him. He was the male lead in Heathers, the off-Broadway musical, mm-hmm. when it opened. I didn't actually make the connection, but
and I didn't then either.
And he's also, I believe, he's on two TV shows, or has been on two TV series since then, or two. He's done TV work at any rate. So he seems to be doing very well. And they also made the point in a video that they showed this year that the young woman who won last year was literally, I guess for reasons that are somewhat obvious, but was plucked to star as Kim in the current London revival of Miss Saigon.
She didn't win, actually. She didn't win
right.
last year. She,
oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Yeah. My mistake. But just like American Idol, yeah. sometimes it's not always the winners.
Yeah.
But yes.
Depends on how you define the winner.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, and I think you made that point 2 weeks ago, James. Mm. But yes, so I think people are really starting to notice, you know, and these kids and like take a look at them.
People have been saying that you know, she got good reviews in London. May I point out that they weren't good reviews. They were raves. I'm looking at them now. Its most notable feature is 18-year-old Ava Noblezada, who seems a remarkable find. That's one. A sensational find, said another. Admirably poised, said another. Grace and vulnerability, a voice of piercing purity. Noblezada is a revelation in her professional debut. Noblezada makes an astonishing stage debut. She has poise, power, and a superb voice throughout a seriously wide vocal range. Now, Michael Coveney from What's On Stage didn't think the revival was up to the original, but he did say, in one area, though, it is its equal, in the casting of 18-year-old Ava Noblezada, whose astonishing voice is flawless and wise. Really, I could go on. I mean, these are from different people, and look what happened. So, and all this, and just about 56 weeks ago, she was getting ready to be in the Jimmys.
Peter, do you think that perhaps Leia Salonga might crash the plane, the helicopter into her? You
know, Pan
type of thing.
I'm sure she wishes. Who dropped Peter Pan? Oh, you know about that book?
Oh yeah.
Oh, Michael does too. Everybody's.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. We'll have to have a whole podcast on Who Dropped Peter Pan.
I was reading it on the A train between 59th and 125th Street, and I screamed so loud when I realized what this book was really about. The people were scared to death that they had all these stops ahead of them with this madman on the train.
We
dropped Peter Pan. The author definitely says that she did not have the Paperboy Playhouse in mind, but read the book and see if she didn't.
Well, so all I know is a friend of mine was the stage manager of one of the shows in question, and my friend's name is JP, and in the book he's PJ.
I see.
So that gives you some idea of what
it's it's a little bit reversed. So.
Yes, no, I don't think. I think he was going to be a wonderful sport about it, because after all, she's aged out of the role.
I know
you're kidding. Of course, yeah.
So, you know, yeah. We had, oh my goodness, about 3 years ago, we had an interview on Broadway Radio with Leia Salonga, and it was a technical train wreck, and we ended up never broadcasting it because the audio quality was so bad. And she talked to us for like an hour. She was great and wonderful. And she was actually in rehearsal for something. I forget what it was. And she took her in between her rehearsal during her lunch hour and actually ran over. They had to call her back to rehearsal while in the middle of the interview. And then we ended up never doing it. But she's so so wonderful, so nice. But Peter, I wanted to ask you about the Jimmy Awards and the International Theater Festival, the International Thespian Festival. Is there any crossover there? Do you see the same sorts of people at performers at the Thespian Festival that you see at the Jimmys, or do they talk about it at each other and things like that?
I can't say I heard a word at one about the other. No, I did not. It wouldn't surprise me at all if one of the kids I saw in the Leeds was one of the kids in the Jimmys, but I didn't hear any crossover at all. So,
and for listeners out there, I have found that Alex Stone from the International Theater, International Thespian Festival, has a YouTube channel, and I will post it. He's got a bunch of his musical theater performances there, so that you can check it out and see,
including the one that knocked out Mark Shaiman. You know, it's one thing for a person who's auditioning to applaud the auditioner. That's pretty astonishing, if indeed the person at the piano applauds. But what happens when he's so moved that he gets up and hugs the kid? I mean, you know, really, is that a performance, or is that a performance? So there.
Well, again, meeting our heroes, you know.
Yes, meeting our heroes indeed. Yeah. Sure.
All right. So, Michael, do you need to leave right now?
Yeah, I need to leave you. But before I do, I just wanted to mention that I think I mentioned that my interview with Mary Rogers.
Oh, yeah.
Has been published in the Sondheim Review, yeah. Which normally you can only get in hard copy form. It's a quarterly magazine about all things Sondheim. But I think there may be an effort afoot to put the interview online. So if that happens, I'll let you all know. And if not, you can stop at the Theater Circle on 44th Street or the Drama Bookshop, and they carry the Sondheim Review. It's really, you should get to know the publication if you don't know it.
Oh, yeah.
But yes, as it happened, I interviewed Mary Rogers, I think, about 2 or 2.5 months before she died, and specifically about her 70-year friendship with Sondheim and occasionally working with him and the people in their circle, including Arthur Lawrence, about whom she finally did make a comment to me, because famously she had been the New York Magazine had done a big thing on Lawrence a few years ago, I guess around the time of the West Side Story revival, and they had called many people to speak about him, and Mary Rogers had said, "Call me back when he's dead."
Ooh.
And yeah,
they did,
and then actually, well, maybe I think they did, but also the New York Times called her back after he died, and she still had no comment. But for whatever reason, I guess it was the way it came up when we were discussing Sondheim and Hal Prince and Sheldon Harnick and all of those young people who were kind of came up together and were friends, were working with each other. She did speak about him, and I wouldn't say it's like earth shattering or anything, but she I think she was very honest and without being nasty, and it's worth seeing.
Did she
her.
See Mill?
Well, yeah. Well, yes, because I think I had mentioned when the Transport Group did a concert version of Once Upon a Mattress last year, she was there, and she did not seem well, but she did get up and she spoke about how she was not doing well, and she told the audience, "Don't smoke." And then when I interviewed her two or three months ago, I asked about her health, and she said that she has emphysema, and she's pretty much tethered to oxygen, and she can't go out anymore. So I guess it had gotten progressively worse. I had no idea that she would be gone within 3 months, but I knew she was not well. So that. You know, I mean, that is a great loss. I Once Upon a Mattress is one of my favorite shows. I think it's gotten, except for the original production, obviously, I don't think it's done well in other revivals and productions that I've seen, including the TV version with Tracy Ullman, which wasn't terrible, but I don't think it got the tone and the humor of the piece. And there were a lot of rewrites and reorchestrations and things like that. But I guess one of my fantasies is to someday do a really excellent production of Once Upon a Mattress. And if I do, I will certainly dedicate it to her.
All right.
Wonderful. So, yeah. The better. All right, Michael.
All right, Michael. So you have a great one. We'll speak to you next week.
Yes, thanks, guys.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
With us this morning, we have a special guest. Robin DeJesus is with us. Our listeners will know Robin from In the Heights, where he got a Tony nomination and a Drama Desk Award. La Caja Fall, where he got a Tony and Drama Desk nominations as well, and Rent. He's been busy working all over, doing lots of great things. But coming up, he is going to be doing a show at the New York Musical Theater Festival called Mother Jones and the Children's Crusade. So we wanted to say hello and see how everything is going. Robin, good morning.
Good morning, James. How's it going? Morning, Peter.
Hi.
Hi. So tell us, you know, you are, we're recording on Sunday the 13th in the morning, and on Thursday the 17th through Thursday the 24th, you have your show at the New York Musical Theater Festival. So tell us, how is it going, and tell us what you're up to.
Well, I think we're on the right track if I'm having to take, you know, NyQuil, Ezequiel, to get to bed, because I'm that could possibly be. No, everything's going really well. You know, it's really interesting being a part of the NIM process, just because, you know, you are consistently working on the show and rewriting it, and it kind of feels like being in previews for an out-of-town show or a Broadway show. So I think... Or we thought we were frozen as of this weekend, but it appears that there might be a change today. But it's also exciting because, you know, the piece, you see it getting stronger and better, and it ultimately, after you get your lines memorized, it makes your job so much easier. But it's been a crazy, fun experience and incredibly full circle for me, because the writer of this show, Cheryl Ekemeny, she was my mentor growing up. She put me on scholarship to her acting school when I was in high school, gave me free voice lessons, sent me to her voice teacher, who also gave me free voice lessons. She got me my first ever professional audition, which was for an indie movie I did called Camp that I ended up doing and like jump-started my career. Our producer, Ben Simpson, was also one of her students. I was his summer camp counselor. His family is like my extended meshpucha. I spend the holidays with them, and so it's a big family affair, and it's just so weird to like look around at the creative team, and you're getting a slice of home, but except we're in New York putting on this show, it's really crazy and amazing.
All right, now, given the fact that she's been your mentor, in fact, did she have you in mind for this role when she was writing it?
No. What's funny is, I know you. That should be insulted. No. Well, yes and no.
Okay.
No, in that this show is actually a show that she wrote for kids to do originally, because one of the things that she did was she would write original shows for the kids to do at the theater. So we actually always grew up having shows kind of written for us, but I didn't originate this role. I did another role in the show called Gottlieb. But now, you know, casting adults, she's totally rewritten the show and made it for adults. And also, you know, skimmed out all the fat of like making sure there are roles for all the other kids in the school. So whereas before we do this show with 40 some odd kids, now we're doing it with 13 people, which is a huge downside. But I had done a reading of this show before where I played another role, Thomas, that has since been cut and basically merged with Jack Dorsey. So for this current rewrite, she was thinking about me. But it's kind of a mashup of multiple characters that have been there that she's based off of other people as well. So that's why I say yes and no for this role of Jack Dorsey. And he's super interesting, you know, for me, it's very different in that he's not necessarily the comedic relief. He's a young man in the 1920s who is a union organizer and a factory worker, very poor, no parents, takes care of his little brother. And the union is paying for him to go to law school so that he can represent them, so that they can have one of their own fighting for them, as opposed to some hotshot from the city.
Gotcha. All right, this is based on a true story?
Yes. Mother Jones was an amazing activist in the early 1900s, and she's kind of one of those people that people kind of know her. You know, there's a magazine named after her.
Right, I remember that.
But she's not like one of the people you learn about in school. Mother Jones was an activist basically for anyone who was underrepresented or being abused of. If she felt you needed help, she would show up and help you with your cause. And our show focuses mainly on in Virginia. It starts off in Virginia, but she leaves and goes to Pennsylvania, where a lot of kids were being hurt working in factories and being overworked. And the reason they were working underage children was because the kids' parents were not making enough money, so the kids had to go to work and not go to school. And so she kind of comes in to help the children and to help the parents get raises so the kids wouldn't have to go to work. And of course, within that, there's also, you know, there's a story of a young girl who wants to become an organizer as well and is working with her own fear. And then there's a comedic love plot that I'm a part of another girl who's kind of superficial and ditzy Southern Belle who's kind of discovering that perhaps she's meant to do more in life. And I'm totally doing it a disservice by talking about it, because it's better to see than to explain, I think, the show.
Well, but obviously, but you're a good luck charm, because there's never been a Broadway musical you've been in that hasn't won a Tony Award in one form or another. I mean, you started off in Rant, In the Heights, and of course, La Cage won its third Best Revival Tony under those circumstances. So you seem to be good luck.
It will, from your mouth to God's ears, that it is happening with this as well.
Tell me about your audition for Rent. I know you started off just as being the man with the squeegee, but then you moved up to Angel. So they must have believed in you tremendously.
I got to go on a lot for Angel. I never officially like replaced, but I did do big chunks of time during vacations and stuff like that in the show. Mm-hmm. It was really, you know, I used to be, and I still struggle with nerves, especially when it comes to auditions. It's sort of like a manifestation of my self-sabotage within my crazy psyche. But back then, especially, I was such a weak auditioner. But thankfully, that show had been so ingrained musically in my mind, because I grew up listening to it.
Sure.
And,
sure,
you know, like at school building sets and playing in the background, you know. So when I got the phone call, I was waiting tables at a restaurant in Connecticut where I'm from called Bertucci's. And I had been working takeout. And I got a phone call on my cell phone, which we weren't supposed to answer, but it said 212. So I asked my friend, when it says 212, it's Broadway calling. And that day, it literally was. And so I ran to the corner and like hid from my manager and got the phone call. And they said, hey, can you be in the city tomorrow for like an 11:35 appointment or something like that? And I said, is there anything late in the day? She's like, no, that's it. I told my manager, who was incredibly understanding. He made sure I didn't close the restaurant. He let me go early. I went home, looked at the material, went into the city, tried to get my best Rent outfit as possible. So that's the closest thing to Rent that I had in the closet. And I got in and you know, I was more confident than I usually was, even in just my way of speaking to people, which I think was just, I sort of felt something tell me I was in the right place at the right time. I sang, and then I left, and I tried to forget it, and then they called me back an hour later and said, hey, can you come back within the next hour and dance for us? And dancing is completely my Achilles heel, and I didn't bring dance clothes. They're like, don't worry about it, it's just going to be a one-on-one session. The creative team loved you, but they want to see you dance. So I feel like I'm just walking toward my death as I go back to Bernie Telsey's office, and who was the casting agent, Bernard Telsey, and I got there. And I just felt not hot. I did not feel like I was the best, but I tried my best. I left the room and I ran into friends from back home in New York, because back then, commuting from Connecticut, if I had to come in for an audition, I would spend the rest of the day, because I just figured, hey, I'm here. Sure, I might as well see a show or do something. I ran to friends and they said, you know, how's the acting thing going? I was like, ugh, I just had an audition for a Broadway show, but I'm pretty sure I didn't get it. And then the next morning I wake up and it's a 212.
Yeah.
And it was my agents, but I didn't think Broadway was calling. And I remember my agent at the time, it was actually his last day at the office. And he said, hey Robin, so, how does a Broadway contract sound? And of course I screamed and I thought it was like the most amazing epic thing in the world. And I began to email and call everyone and stop. Sure. And I was at the theater that night. So within 24 hours, I went from auditioning to being at the theater, watching the show, getting ready to learn it.
How wonderful. I also think it's very funny that you said dancing is my Achilles heel. That's a very good that's mixing a metaphor of sorts. So anyway, did you know Lin-Manuel? Did you know Lin-Manuel Miranda before In the Heights? Had you run into him in any way, shape, or form? And he said, "I'm writing this show, and there might be a good part for you," or anything like that.
No, I had never met Lin. At the time, I thought I was going to go to college because I'd never gone, and I wanted to attempt. And friends of mine had seen a reading of In the Heights at the Manhattan Theater Club, and I had waited tables with them. And one of them said to me, "Robin, you need to go in for this show, In the Heights. I saw a reading of it." And our friend Orlando played the role of Sonny, the role that I played. And Orlando had booked a boy band, and he was in Miami doing the whole pop career thing. And he said, "The role's up for grabs. You should go in." So I called my agents and told them to keep an eye out for it. And then I saw they were doing it at the O'Neill. And so I told them, and they made a couple phone calls, and you know, they were supposed to get me an audition. And then about 2 weeks later, I hadn't heard anything. About 2 or 3 weeks later, I was at the McCarter doing a show, and
yes,
I get a phone call.
Yes, I saw you do it, in fact.
Oh, you saw that?
Yeah, the Skin of Our Teeth musical, right?
Yeah, so the Skin of Our Teeth. It was.
See, you went to college for one day because you were at Princeton. So I mean,
exactly,
it was that.
Exactly.
Okay.
I visited. That was about it. And so I got the phone call that they just offered it. Apparently, Lin and the creative team had seen camp, and they felt good enough to just have me do the reading for this, because it was kind of, there was no risk. It was just 2 weeks, you know, fill in for the part, and you know, hopefully they'll enjoy what I did, or if not, you know, they can rewrite it or whatever. And it was one of those things, they wouldn't give us a script beforehand. He didn't let us listen to the music. We get to the O'Neill, which is the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center, is already such a magical place. Mm-hmm. And we get there, and they say, "Okay, we're going to do a cold read." And we sit down, and I immediately knew who this character was. I immediately understood his conflict. I knew where he was coming from. His words fit in my mouth in a way that I to this day have yet to experience again. And I just knew, like, the show needed work, but there was something so magical about it. And we, as a cast, just completely fell in love with one another. And by the end of those 2 weeks, we were sobbing as if we had known each other for years and were being separated. It was the best. And to this day, it still is the best experience I've had, which for a while I think ruined some of us.
We were like,
how do we deal with life post In the Heights?
And sure,
because especially, like, you know, you deal with being at such a high place emotionally, but also career wise, and then you kind of in a way go back to normal life. And I think we've all learned to deal with it and think of it as like it's just this amazing moment in our lives that we were just so lucky to experience, And now we move on, and it's all good. And you know what? Maybe it'll happen again. Maybe it won't. But we have this incredible group of friends that we just go back to every few months or every few years if we have a reunion or whatever. And it's like family, which doesn't happen with every show.
No, it certainly doesn't.
Sure. So tell us, what was your experience in La Cage? Do you have a story that, how did you end up in La Cage?
La Cage was so fascinating because originally I did not want to go in for it. I felt uncomfortable. I didn't know what I was supposed to bring or what was unique about me. And I was very lost, and I initially turned down the audition, and my agent lovingly advised me to please go in the next time they came around. And I think what convinced me was the director, Terry Johnson. I was very fascinated with his history and his vision of the show. And I thought, oh, that's very different and interesting. And I think historically more accurate than the previous productions. The previous productions were amazing. But yeah. I do think a club full of drag queens in the 1970s would have been a hidden place. I doubt that it would have been a mainstream, lavish, elegant place that everyone knew. I think it would have been more seedy and hidden, perhaps at the end of a dark alleyway so that no one got in trouble or hurt. I thought that was really interesting and dark. And I went in and I did this completely different thing with it that I thought maybe they'll go for, or maybe they'll just think I'm crazy. And thank God they actually, they went for my take on the character. And then once we did it, I remember being at a table read and everyone was sort of, you know, doing what they usually did with material like that of Hodge. And then Douglas Hodge made his entrance at the table read and we went, oh, that's the tone of this show.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is.
And I'd say, yeah. I'd say you were destined to be in it from the beginning because your birthday, day you were born, was literally the first anniversary celebration of La Cage aux Folles on Broadway. So, I think it was meant to be. So,
that is amazing. I had no idea. Thank you for telling me that.
Sure.
Wow, that's funny. That's really funny.
So,
thank you.
You are off to rehearsal in just a few minutes. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. So let's remind everybody that you could see Mother Jones and the Children's Crusade Thursday, July 17th through Thursday, July 24th, various times. We have information on the show in our show notes, or you can go to, what was it? It was Mother Jones Musical.com.
We've also extended as well.
Oh,
sorry,
yeah.
We've extended. We've added a performance on the 26th as well.
On the 26th? Okay. So MotherJonesMusical.com. Robin, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. And we can check out, follow Robin at Robin of Jesus on Twitter and Instagram and get in touch with him there. All righty? So, Robin, have a great rehearsal today, and we'll speak with you soon.
Indeed.
Thank you, James.
Bye-bye.
Take care, Peter. Bye. All the best. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, Peter, so anything coming up for you that we should mention before we go?
Well, yes. In fact, I'm going to be seeing Mother Jones and the Children's Crusade this week as one of the musicals that I'm really looking forward to. I'm also seeing Valueville tonight, Donna Lynn Champlin's show, and that'll also be a wonderful experience. I'm zipping up to Stores, Connecticut, to see Leslie Uggams do Gypsy, so that should be fun. And Pump Boys this week too, Piece of My Heart. Yeah, it's going to be a busy week.
Great, we'll have a lot to talk about next week. Not that we ever suffer from things to talk about, do we?
No, we really don't. So,
all right, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to broadwayradio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. You can also listen to us in many different ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and stream This Week on Broadway directly to you. We also get played on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, including links to Mother Jones Musical, to Robin DeJesus on Twitter, also to Alex Stone on YouTube. So check all those things out. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye. Mother Jones.